This is the Future Great City Podcast from NextSTL.com. Today, we're joined by Rasheen Aldridge Jr. Born and raised in St. Louis, Rasheen is a community organizer and activist. Currently, he's also a candidate for the 5th Ward Democratic Committeeman position. Named to the Ferguson Commission, Rasheen has protested on the streets of Ferguson and been a guest of President Barack Obama at the White House. He also serves as director of an organization called Young Activists United St. Louis and sits as student co-chair on the Missouri Jobs with Justice. In addition, Rasheen is a leader in the Show Me 15 workers' rights movement, advocating living wages for fast food workers and others. So welcome, Rasheen. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and welcome to the, we're recording here at Space Architects in the 17th Ward of the city of St. Louis. And now you're a 5th Ward resident, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, and you're hoping to represent the 5th Ward, is that right?
Yes, sir, running for committee man in the August 2nd election.
All right, and what does that entail? What are you doing to run for committee man?
So there's 28 wards in the city. In each ward, there's a committee man and a committee woman. The job of the committee person is basically to increase voter turnout and to hold monthly committee meetings. We in the 5th Ward, we don't have a high turnout. We're one of the lowest turnouts in the 5th Ward. And we don't have monthly meetings. So, you know, community neighbors can come together to meet and talk about issues such as crime, such as different opportunities where we can be coming together. So me and Megan Betts, she's also running for 5th Ward committee woman, are running for committee people to really try to bring back that sense of community, that sense of neighborhood, you know, block parties, increasing and getting more young people engaged, trying to potentially even implement something called participatory budgeting, working with the alderwoman. So it's really just getting the community active and getting them engaged in the process and making sure that everyone is meeting and knowing each other. And that's what me and Megan is really trying to bring back to the 5th Ward.
So in St. Louis, the party committee people actually do have not any power in terms of, like, you know, authority to make decisions, but it's an important position in St. Louis, and it's kind of behind the scenes a little bit, but it's something that can make a difference. Is that, we say that's accurate? I mean, it seems like it's unrecognized that's like, there's a lot of potential in that position.
It definitely is. I mean, a lot of people do not, you know, when it comes to the committee level races, you know, it's not really important, one, because it's not a paid position, and, you know, people got to pay their bills. So taking a risk to run for office and not get paid is a little difficult. But also, too, like I say, people don't look at committee being an important position, but committee seat is very important. It also, the committee, central body committee, allocates where funds go to the different candidates. So right now, the central committee is very not active. So even as you look across the ward, not in just the 5th Ward, all across 28 wards, there are a lot of people running for these committee races because we understand how important it is that we do need to get our wards more engaged, but we need to bring some transparency and real accountability to the central committee and making it not private meetings, but public, so the community can be aware of what's going on and part of the process.
And so what's happening in the 5th Ward? How would you describe the 5th Ward in the city of St. Louis, and what's good, what's bad, what's happening in your part of the city?
So the 5th Ward is very diverse. The 5th Ward has a bit of downtown west. We also have Preservation Square, Murphy Park, O'Fallon, Cochrane, and then you have St. Louis Place, Old North. So it's very diverse and it's very beautiful. I think that's what's unique about the 5th Ward. We have a lot going on right now in the 5th Ward. The NGA is moving in.
Mm-hmm. And so this is we've talked about it on other podcasts, on the websites, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. They're building something, who knows how much it'll end up costing, $1.7 billion, something like that, on 99 acres on, I guess would be the northwest corner of the ward, I guess, incorporates the ward.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of the 5th and it's a little bit of the 3rd. Yeah. The way they cut up the wards is it's so crazy. But
and I know it's not a simple issue, but is that good news? Is it bad news? Is it
it is
a
not
a little bit of both?
It is not simple, but It is a little bit of both. I think the biggest issue right now with it, though, is the moving of the people out of their homes. Mm-hmm. You know, people that have been in that community for so long, and the amount of money that they're trying to, the little bit of money that they're trying to give these people to move out of their homes, it's really disrespectful to the community. It's really disrespectful to the people who decided to, you know, want to stay there, raise kids there. Mm-hmm. Families have died there, and other families have, you know, said we're going to keep these homes. So the fact that the city is only trying to give some folks like $16,000 is just... It's unbelievable to say, just restart your whole life. So
yeah, and a lot of times these are based on multiples of quote market value. And as people have followed this issue, you know, the disinvestment in the area and some of the Northside regeneration stuff that's, you know, bought homes and made them vacant or let them fall down has decreased property values. And then, you know, so people are getting even less than they would have, you know, in recent history. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So that's, I mean, that's going to be the biggest thing happening in this ward for the next decade.
For the next couple, yeah.
Defining in a lot of ways for the ward. But what else is happening?
I mean, well, also in the fifth ward, you got, like I said, you got a lot of people that are getting active and getting kind of upset the way that the ward has been ran. With the ward being so unique and diverse, it's not really brought together. A portion of the ward, a lot of the times, is left out. So the downtown section and Old North people are usually told that they're not part of the 5th. And we only focus on the middle central corridor, Murphy Park, O'Fallon, Carr Square. So,
well, that's where the votes have been. Is that fair to say? That's how the alderwoman has been elected.
That's where the absentee votes are at, right? but that's not where all the votes are at. Even when Michelle just ran a Glasgow election, who stayed downtown. I worked the polls the whole day, and I worked when my mom had ran against Tamika years ago and when she ran for committee woman. And I never seen so many, to be honest, white downtown people come to Carr Square to vote.
So, and it was a close election, right?
It was very close. Yeah. It was very close, but she didn't have an absentee game, and we'll just leave that there. But it is made up of many different people, so the votes aren't just in the middle part. And we just, as a community, we can't just look at, you know, the votes are in the middle part. We need to bring in everyone. We need to make sure that everyone's voices are heard because we can learn from each other.
Right. And I know you're going to leave that there, but I'll run with it a little bit. And the absentee votes are basically the Tamika and the Hubbards and that ward has been able to generate. I don't know what the right word is. I don't live in the ward. So manufacture, produce, conjure up lots of absentee votes. I mean, they've had that. They have a structure there.
Bully seniors and go inside and
Have a lot of people who they can get to the polls or they can hand a form to and fill out and they can eke out victories. And it's one of those wards that seems ripe for a turnover. Like you said, if you start energizing, if the entire ward, if the vote was equal, you know, if participation was equal across the entire ward, you might get a different result. Mm-hmm. I imagine that's what you're thinking as well. So
we're definitely, I mean, with me, Megan, and also Bruce, who's running for state rep against Penny as well, we're not worried about the absentee because if you look at it, there's about 5,000 some registered voters in the ward, and they only usually tap into 900. So there's a big lack of people who don't feel like they're part of the process. So we're trying to get from downtown to Carr Square to Murphy Park all the way to Old North to St. Louis Place, everyone engaged because this is our community. So I know it's difficult for the downtown people because they're moving in and out, but this is their neighborhood as well. This is their community as well. So we want them to feel a part and want them to know that they have a voice and a say-so.
So you're involved at the local ward committee level, which is about as grassroots, small-time politics as you can possibly imagine. On the other hand, in going back just a few months, you were in Washington, D.C., sitting down with President Obama. it's got to be kind of surreal, right?
Man, like, I remember in 2008, me and my grandmother watching every primary on CNN, every general election, or every primary, you know, as they came in. No one really knew who Obama was, but after a while, you know, he started speaking and he just started to touch you and then you started to pay attention to him. So to watch him one day slowly pick up these states and to become the nominee and to, you know, become the president, staying up all night, seeing him win states like North Carolina and Ohio and, you know, states that he wasn't supposed to that was going to make him the eventual president was exciting.
So in 2008, I gather, if my math is right, you were not probably old enough to vote for him, and were you?
I was in eighth grade. I was just about to go to high school that next year. Yeah, I was not old enough.
But you were already engaged in politics. You were watching local and national events. So
I'll take that back. I was a freshman. So
okay.
But 4 years later, when I was a senior, I definitely make sure I voted for him. But
so you met the president, and we'll get to why in a little bit. We don't want to miss that point. And he had a lot of, well, he had some really nice things to say about you, right? I mean, he was very complimentary, and not just meet him. Lots of people meet him or say hi or something, but he talked about you in the press and said, you know, this is the kind of man we need leading the next generation in our cities and in our country. And then you turned around and said, I'm really disappointed in the president. Why?
It wasn't, man.
That's an unfair setup, but that's the gist of it.
You learn about how media goes a little bit. You say something like disappointment and they run with it. But we had met with the president, and it was an honor. I'm great.
And this is because you serve on the Ferguson Commission, mm-hmm. And you were involved in some of the protests out there, and I imagine through the Ferguson Commission is how you got to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. But so, it was just more of the setup. You know, we had met mm-hmm. with the president for about 45 minutes, and he extended the time with it was me and Brittany Packnack, who also served on the commission, and other activists from Ferguson, New York, and Ohio, to talk about, you know, what had recently happened, not just in Ferguson, but, you know, racial tensions, police brutality, and just he really wanted to hear solutions from us. He didn't want to hear stories. He really wanted to hear what can we do in the White House to make your communities better. Mm-hmm. So we talked for about 45 minutes, and then after that, we went into the larger room. Now, being a new guy, I didn't necessarily know how things work. So when we went into the larger room and we seen some of the bigger wigs, you know, the Al Sharptons and the vice president, I shouldn't say big wigs, but some bigger name people. And as we had this press conference, I started to almost feel as if was we part of some bigger plan, being part of meeting him individually and then going to this press conference. But once again, not knowing how all things work out, I felt like we wasn't really given the attention that we really was deserved. Mm-hmm. And going into this larger room, debriefing what we just talked about, I felt like it really wasn't serious a little bit. But he did. He showed me some love at the press conference.
Well, so, I mean, that's got to be... And I feel like I, you know, understand what you're saying. It's got to be so difficult as a president. Like you spend 20 minutes with 100 different people or something, right? Like I have no idea how anyone in that position would make those interactions feel genuine and truly make you feel like you're listened to. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I mean? I've had that experience locally, right? I meet with an alderman and I'm like, that person didn't listen to me, you know? So, and that person's got, you know, isn't the president.
But in that 45 minute conversation, I mean, he, mm-hmm. I can tell he was zoned in. I mean,
you did find him. I mean, he was engaged.
He was engaged in the conversation, but it was, I think to see all the other folks that I didn't necessarily feel was always on the right side. It was like, what's really going on here?
Yeah. Well, things get, I'm not that old, but things get complicated pretty quick. You know, I think you start out feeling like I'm going to criticize anybody I want. You know, I'm going to say what I want. I'm going to say I'm disappointed in the president. And then, as you get older, things have a way of, I don't know.
I don't know
what happens to you, but we need those young voices kind of standing up and saying what they feel. And everyone should feel free to say, hey, I talked to the president for 45 minutes and I didn't feel like we got much out of it. You know, that's not an unfair, comment in any way.
I still call him my uncle. So Uncle Obama.
So, but you feel some connection. You talked about 2008, watching him as a, you know, 15-year-old or 16-year-old in high school. And feeling a connection because he grew up on the south side of Chicago as a community organizer. He dealt, you know, with a lot of the grassroots community issues that you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's something. So you have that probably builds in a lot of expectations in terms of how you think he can help, right?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess you won't necessarily, even with a friend, you don't always agree with them all the time, right? So, and there's decisions I think, you know, the president made that no one has always and said, you know, the president has been right, but. He, at the end of the day, I think his values as being a community organizer, and there's starting from there, not too many people understand real issues, in my opinion, if you haven't really been on the ground talking to the people, been in the trenches, and he have. So I'm so grateful, like I say, that he even invited us and really wanted to hear from the young people and hear not just stories and not just, you know, this is what's going on, because we know what's been going on across this nation for years when it comes to race. But he wanted to hear how can we make it better in Ferguson? How can we make it better in St. Louis? Mm-hmm. How can we make it better in New York, Ohio? How can we as an administration do what we need to do? But also, he told us, go back home and keep the pressure on your local elected officials, because that's where it starts. If you don't keep the pressure on the ground on a local level, nothing's going to happen.
Right.
He's only, I mean, he can do executive orders all day, but we have to really get people engaged and get people involved and build an army of people who feel like, you know, they want better in their community, educate folks about the issues that are going on so they be aware and engaged.
Well, that's something that if we've learned one thing in St. Louis, it's that we can, these issues are local, and the federal laws and rules can be whatever they are, and our local officials will act in the way that serves their interest and their voters want, right? Yeah. So I mean, that goes all the way back to the 50s, 60s, and all federal housing policies and all kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. This community has resisted those types of changes for a very long time.
But I'm optimistic. I feel like this is the year, even if, as you see it on a national level with the Bernie and the Hillary, and even on the Republican side, I mean, with the Donald Trump and the Ted Cruz, the establishment and the non-establishment, all the way on a local level, here in St. Louis, people are upset. You know, people are tired of feeling like their voices do not matter. People are tired of not having transparency and accountability. It's not too much to ask for. People want to be part of the process. We don't want to hear your vote. You don't have a vote in this process if we're going to build a new stadium, or your voice is not going to be heard on this issue. Your voice is not going to be heard on this issue. I understand we vote people in to represent us, but we don't vote people in to just make complete decisions without us. And I think people are really fed up and tired, and I'm optimistic that this election season, it's going to be a lot of people in positions that's going to bring the power back to communities and the voices back to communities.
And so, you're engaged in so many ways, but let's go back to August, the beginning of August 2014. What were you doing? What was your activity, and what were your how were you engaged in the community at that point?
So August of 2014, I was actually working at National Alamo. Was very involved with the fight for 15 low-wage workers that have been fighting for 15 in the union.
And that's an effort to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
To raise the minimum wage to 15, and then for union rights in the workplace, for protections and benefits and stuff like that. But was working at National Alamo, just cleaning cars, and then heard about, you know, the death of Mike Brown through Facebook.
Yeah.
And really thought, honestly, when I first seen it, I thought not much of it, you know, because the reality is this was nothing new of, you know, a young African-American being gunned down at the hands of police, a Fox News article, a Channel 4 article, St. Louis Post-Dispatch article that we didn't seen, you know, before, of a young black person being gunned down. But later to see the reactions on Twitter and how the community was being treated, and the dogs and the how long his body laid out there, started to just make me question, like, there's more going on to this story than just another young guy being shot down at the hands of the police. The way that the police and they were acting towards the community, and the way that his body just, I mean, laid out there for 4.5 hours. And we know St. Louis. If you know St. Louis in August, it's hot. It's humid. So that concrete was smoking, and for his body to be burning out there for that long, we don't even leave dogs outside that long.
So there's clearly a tipping point for the community, and not just Ferguson. I don't know what the ratio was, but people congregated there. Yeah, the 21st Ward Alderman Antonio French, you were there. I had friends who went out there. I don't know, and some of it's like, in a very, I don't mean this in a really crass way, but some of it's like, it's a spectacle. It was the, for people who care about the community, it was an outlet to be able to go and say, I care about this community. And that, maybe that's overly basic, but at what point did you make the decision that I'm driving to Ferguson? Cause you're a city resident. Mm-hmm. It's quote, not your community, right? When did you go, and what was the point where you thought, I have to be there on the ground, and I have to be there in person?
So I went day two, and I ended up calling my sister, Janina Jenkins, in the fast food movement. It was originally because she worked out at the McDonald's on West Florissant, and so not too far from the incident to happen. Mm-hmm. I called her the night before just to be like, do you know what happened? You know, I'm seeing all this stuff on Twitter. What's really going on? And she was like, I heard gunshots, but, you know, I'm not aware. I hear people saying that somebody was shot. So the second day, me and her had went out to Ferguson just to like hear the story and just try to see what was going on. And then, in a way, as you know, people was protesting, tried to use the skills that we learned from Show Me 15, right? Which, is not necessarily even typical organizing, random, are these strikes and low wage workers going out on strike rolling city. So it's not your typical organizing either, but try to use some of those skills out there. But we quickly found out that those skills that we learned in Show Me 15 necessarily wasn't the right ones for this situation. It was a crisis. It was much different. And then we quickly also found ourselves getting from trying to help to also being affected, seeing the reaction of the police, seeing the way that people was being treated for trying to peacefully protest. So it was like, hold on, wait, you know, it quickly turned into like, the guy that's standing next to me is my brother and sister, so quickly turned into a family and protected each other. But it originally started as just like trying to see what happened, what's going on, and it turned into anger quick. And I think it was a little different for me because I was born and raised here in St. Louis. I lived in the city, but I went to school in Parkway, so I kind of had like the best of both worlds, right? I went out to school to this place where there was many opportunities. You can walk outside, walk down the street to the gas station with your friends and just feel free. Go to the park. And I mean,
this is part of the school system, the busing system.
The DSAE program.
Yeah, so you got up in the morning and got on a bus and headed to the county to go to a good school.
Kindergarten all the way to 12th grade. But when I was in my own community, it was weird. I almost felt like I was in cage. So I had a different type of reaction with police. I didn't necessarily have, I wasn't the stereotype that they like to label, you know, dreadhead, that sag that they always, and I'm just being honest, you know, that they like to pull over and mess with. I was pulled over, and as I used to drive in the neighborhood, and I was, you know, asked where I was going as I used to walk up the street, but not as much as my other black brothers and sisters. So when Ferguson happened, I kind of gave the law enforcement the benefit of the doubt. But once I seen how, you know, people were just out there trying to voice their opinion, and you know, we was being called N-words and we were being laughed at and being shot with tear gas, and the media didn't make it no better, right? When you go home and you see across CNN and all these other stations, you're being called a thug, and it's like, you know, but it's the law enforcement that's really agitating and making the situation worse. It started to grow this, to be honest, almost this hatred, because I just felt like I was going out there, my brothers and sisters going out there, and we were trying to peacefully do it. And we was told we was wrong. We was told we was stupid. We was told we was uneducated. We was told that basically your life, you don't matter in your own community. So it was like, when I went home, do my life really matter? And that's not something that I want anyone should have to ask himself. Like in this country, do my life really matter? No matter what I'm doing, the right way. Right. And in our eyes, we were trying to do it the right way. I mean, we even stopped people from looting when the National Guard stood in front of us. So it was.
It seems like there's just a lack of ability for these different communities to speak with each other. So there's just, you know, if you don't have any built-in trust, if you don't have any built-in familiarity, then things seem to escalate. And it seems like on an individual basis, it makes sense. Right. So you go out to protest, all of a sudden you're dealing with tear gas and things like that, and you get angry about it. And so at least the energy and the rhetoric escalates. And I can only imagine from the police point of view, they're like, all right, you know, I'm supposed to go out on the street and stop people from marching down the street, and it's not working, and we're throwing tear gas and it's still not working. So they're escalating their energy and opposition. And obviously, we don't need to tell anybody, it got ugly pretty quick.
And then it was things like, you know, you can't even, you have to keep walking, you know, for 5 seconds or you get arrested.
And it speaks to the lack of the ability of the police to separate, quote, peaceful protesters from looters, you know, and we all, and I think everyone can take a step back and be like, all these factions were there. I mean, there were people there trying to incite real violence, you know, people from Chicago, people from New York, people flew in from out of town to try to create problems. And there just wasn't an ability within the community to effectively separate those things. So, you know, the other point I tend to make, and, you know, I have family calling me concerned about Ferguson and things like that. And never to downplay the importance of the issues at hand, but the incidents were quite overplayed, I think. I mean, I wasn't familiar with that area. I think I'd been to meetings at somewhere out in that area. I'd worked at University of Missouri, St. Louis, so I knew that corner of the community, but I was geographically familiar with it. But it's a really boring stretch of road. It's a McDonald's, it's a strip mall. It's tiny, and like I feel like if you turned on CNN, it would be like, America is burning, and it's like, oh, that's the McDonald's next to the Target, you know? And so it was weird how it was that the violence, the energy was in a way blown out of proportion. I don't know if that resonates with you at all, or if that's just kind of where I'm
No, I agree to an extent. You know, when you've seen, I mean, like CNN and MSNBC and many others kept playing over and over the Quick Trip burning. But, you know, when there's like university students upset about, you know, they lost a basketball game and they burned cars, you only see it for 5 seconds and then story's over. Yeah. But Ferguson was over and over and over. The world is coming down. But to be honest, Ferguson could have been Dale Wood. Ferguson could have been Jennings. Ferguson could have been Ohio, and it was. Ferguson could have been New York, Baltimore, and it was. The situation with what happened with Ferguson is it was a tipping point. It was a tipping point for people of color, because it's not just black, people of color that have already been, there's de-investment in the community. There's no opportunity in the community. On top of that, you have law enforcement that are coming in, you know, ticketing you for the littlest things. I mean, we've seen in the DOJ report, majority of the people that was pulled over in Ferguson were black people for petty little things. And that's not a good way to build, you know, trustful relationships.
And even the percentage, and it's not just like, people can rationalize that in their own mind. I'm sure they're doing it. But they even found that, like, of cars searched, it was more likely they would find drugs on a white person they pulled over than a black person and stuff. I mean, it went to the core of real discrimination. And this is kind of, this isn't debatable anymore, right? Like, it's a fact. And now the community's trying to deal with it. And
I think that's why you get so much anger, and you got people that wasn't even from, like myself, that was not from Ferguson, that came out to Ferguson, because as a young black man, we have and black woman too, and any person I'm sure of color, but in St. Louis, you have had that conversation with your parents about driving down Lucas and Hunt late at night. You have had that conversation about, you know, keeping your hands 10-2 especially when you hit North County. So the situation that happened in Ferguson isn't necessarily nothing new. Seeing the images of Mike Brown, I have seen those images as a young boy of, a person of color being shot down at the hands of police and communities not getting justice. So it's not necessarily anything new. That's why you got this outrage. And then on top of that, the way the situation, I think, was played out was just like to be honest, a slap in the face of people, and almost like public nude-day noosing that his body had to lay out there for 4.5 hours before you pick the crime scenes, I understand, but 4.5 hours, that's a little excessive. So this was just a buildup. It was a buildup. Like I say, it could have been, it could have been the city of St. Louis.
Yeah. So some people have compared this to what happened in Cincinnati. So if you go back 2001, I believe there was a police shooting of a young black teenager in Cincinnati that led to what they're, you know, what people would term riots, I guess, whatever the, you know, unrest, and the National Guard was on the streets in downtown Cincinnati. And a decade on, Cincinnati is kind of held up as a model of how you heal a community. And one of the things that I've commented to people about, and people kind of hold that out as hope, is like Cincinnati did it. They went through something similar. They're finding a lot of success. And I think one of the problems here is that this happened in Ferguson. And for better or worse, people in St. Louis can be like, oh, that was Ferguson. Like, don't ask me how far away that is. It was Ferguson. It's a suburb. It's out there. But on the other hand, I feel like there's no push to change, quote, St. Louis, because it was Ferguson, right? And so, you know, I people would say like, oh, let's all go shop in Ferguson this weekend. Let's support the community. And that's only going to last so long. Look, I live in University City. I'm not driving to Ferguson to go to McDonald's. I'm going to go to one of the 7 I have to pass to get there, right?
Sure. Like,
so that's part of why Ferguson became Ferguson, is because it's a 50s suburb that's declining economically, and it's out of the way, and there's no, you know, there's not much of a reason to go there to shop or for entertainment or for, you know, zoos or museums or something else, right? So what's your outlook on Ferguson? I mean, where does Ferguson go at this point? And do you feel like there's a regional energy to do something about it, or do you feel like people are kind of sitting on the sidelines?
I think that the difference between Ferguson and Cincinnati, one, like you say, it's not necessarily the major city, right?
So I feel like downtown, they're like, the major corporations there were like, oh crap, we've got to fix this, right? Because it's literally down the street from our corporate headquarters.
But the Cincinnati Collective actually came to the Ferguson Commission, and they talked to, we was out there in Ferguson, and they talked to us about their process of how they did things, how they had court orders, how they had some electeds that actually was, you know, actually helped the people. And then just say, oh, for, you know, a couple months, you know, I'm going to be here, and then walk away. But it didn't happen overnight, but there was an ongoing plan. And I think that's similar why we're trying to, Forward Through Ferguson is trying to do similar things that Cincinnati is doing to later down the line make the situations in Ferguson, not necessarily like Cincinnati because we're going to be different, but make it better, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we fix the high police violence that we got in Ferguson? How do we make economic opportunity, not just in Ferguson, but also in these other small municipalities?
Yeah.
It's so...
But you said it could have been any of... dozens of municipalities.
Because I'm right up the street. I mean, it's not that far. Dalewood is not just as big or as Ferguson. It could have happened there, but
well, and people are surprised nationally. They come in, and Ferguson is not the most economically disadvantaged suburb in the region
and
at
it's,
all.
It's and not.
So, you know, when you talk about federal relief and things like that, that can go to Jennings. It can go to Spanish Lake area. It can go lots of places. Mm-hmm. Ferguson's not the worst off of these communities economically.
We need to really think of a plan of how we invest in these de-investment communities, and not just Ferguson, not just Jennings. Zip code 6106 in the city of St. Louis, 5th Ward. Medium income is $15,000. Like, situations like Ferguson, when you continue to have lack of opportunities, are going to continue to happen, as well as when you have police are coming in and not having those relationships with people, when people are already feeling like, what do I have to live for, right? When there's no opportunity. So, like you say, it's we can't forget Ferguson. That's like saying, let's take Selma out of, you know, Selma, right? You cannot forget Ferguson. We need to make sure that Ferguson is still a point of remembrance and what we need to continue to do to make change, not only in Ferguson, but in the St. Louis region. But we also need to make sure we're looking beyond Ferguson, because this couldn't happen again, because Ferguson is not the worst. Mm-hmm. Belle Fountain actually has a worse record when it comes to pulling over African Americans in the area. So we need to make sure that we're really being strategic about where we're putting funds and where we're really putting the opportunities and putting jobs, so people can feel like, okay, to be honest, I have something to live for. When you live in, like you say, you drive down West Florissant and then drive down South Florissant. And why does it have to look like that? Why do I want on one side where majority of one, you know, live? It's nicer, right? There's mm-hmm. businesses, and you drive on the other side of Florissant, it's not the same, right? So the people on the other side of Florissant want those same opportunities, want those jobs, and want their community to look just like South Florissant. But mm-hmm. people and leadership need to listen to the community, listen to the ones who have been most vulnerable, and not the ones who already have it. I don't know other way to say it, but
sure.
until we start to help bottom down and stop top up, there's, like you say, the corporation that's out there in Ferguson, how much help are they? And I know, you know, so many people have really gave all this money to Ferguson, but where is it? And who pockets have a hit in the neighborhood?
Right,
and
community? And that's not going to change policing. It's not going to change municipal courts. It's not going to, you know, but it's, yeah. So there's investment happening on some levels. There's engagement on some levels. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is kind of how you see local activists, not versus, but as opposed to, or if you see them differently than the national activists who've come in, and also maybe local media and national media. Because one of the things I think wasn't surprising to people locally was when you started reading about you know, the proclivity of police departments pulling over African-Americans and ticketing and these municipal court situations. Like, I think locally, in a way, some of these stories had been written, but it was a little bit of like, oh, yeah, I read that in the Post-Dispatch. But then when it showed up in the Washington Post, it was like, oh, crap, our community has a problem. Like, other people noticed, kind of thing. So I can see a benefit on both sides. But I've also heard the criticisms of the activists who've flown in and now made careers out of Ferguson. And they're not from here, and they're mm-hmm. not coming back here, and they may not be helping here that much. So what is, yeah, how do you feel, how do you look at that from someone who's on the ground locally?
Everyone has a, everyone has a role to play, right? And I understand that my role in the movement is trying to help my community, trying to help not only the people in the 5th Ward, but the St. Louis region. And that is also made up of, you know, St. Louis County. So working with activists, working with community members to bring our region to a better situation than we was in 2014, bring our region to a place where people can say, you know, St. Louis is home. And a lot of people can't say necessarily St. Louis home. There has been, you know, folks that since Ferguson, and you don't just see it in Ferguson, you see it throughout history, right? You one or two that becomes a that gets more attention or try or is put to be the voice of the movement.
Yeah, they're given a platform because of either where they came from or who they are or luck or something, right? Mm-hmm.
So I think I don't think it's much different from history, but you know, one thing about the Black Lives Matter movement, I don't think there is no voice, there's no leader. In history, there always have to be a leader of a movement, right? There has to be an MLK, there has to be a Rosa Parks, there has to be a Malcolm X, but there's no leader in the Black Lives Matter movement. So the media does a lot of, and I think it's more the media that's making it worse for people on the ground, and it doesn't always necessarily help relationships, but the media doesn't do well with trying to paint this person as the founder of Black Lives Matter because they created the hashtag, or this person, the founder of Black Lives Matter because they tweet a lot, or this person, the founder of Black Lives Matter because he was the loudest person out there. No one is the leader of this movement, and I think everyone that is out there have similar goals. You know, if it's around police brutality, or if it's around trying to make economic opportunities better, if it's around trying to make housing opportunities better, we all have the same goal, and it's really just bringing opportunities to people who have been left out for so long, bringing the voice to the people who have not felt like they had a voice in so long. So you hear it a lot with, like, you know, like I say, you hear it a lot with the media trying to say this is the forefront. But in my opinion, I try not to worry too much about it, because at the end of the day, like I say, in zip code 6106, people are still worrying about how they're going to pay their bills and still struggling and still getting, you know, killed on a daily basis. So how do we make change now and not get so caught up in that? And I think the ones who are told that they have this, you know, big notoriety, they still have a role to play in being wherever, right? Being here in St. Louis or...
So how would you describe the Black Lives Matter movement or even the concept or idea? So, you know, this is a discussion I have with my, you know, white neighbors, my white family. And it's just kind of like, and I've seen some, you know, these are Facebook memes and stuff that's like, you know, you wouldn't have to say Black Lives Matter if everyone already understood the All Lives Matter, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, and I'm failing at coming up with the right analogy, but it's like, there are all kinds of analogies out there that's just like, you know, we're saying it because this is the disadvantaged group. You know, it doesn't mean we hate everyone else. It doesn't mean anything else. Like, and so, so I don't know how would you characterize it? Why is it important for people to say Black Lives Matter explicitly?
I think you just hit it on the head. I mean, it's not, oh, we hate white folks. You know, oh, Black Lives Matter, so screw white folks, Chinese folks. A lot of folks that was out there with the protesters were Caucasian people that supported the protesters, that protected us, that supported us financially or housed us. And I mean, all people of color out there that was protesting. So the white protesters that was out protesting also got housed by white people or black people. But people say Black Lives Matter because, like you said, we're saying pay attention to these group of people that have been pushed so far to the end. Pay attention to these group of people that have, and it's been proven. I mean, look on the other side of Delmar.
These things should not be debatable.
It's not. I mean, if you literally drive up Delmar and you look on the north side and you look on the south side, there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter. People are saying Black Lives Matter because in our education system in the city, it's worse than in West County. Why is that? And I went to county school and I can tell just even from the bathrooms, it makes so much of a difference of, oh, you know, this one has an automatic, you know, hand dryer. But, you know, in the city school, it's brick and it's like the old toilet foundation and it's still got the paper tiles. People say Black Lives Matter because they want quality health. In zip code 6106, the median income is like 60-some years old. In zip code 6105, Clayton, Missouri, it's 80-something. Why is that? Because people of color are not getting the same opportunities. We're not saying we hate white people. That is not the point. The message is we want to be heard. We want our voices to be heard. We want the same opportunities. We want the same type of police that police West County and don't mess with their neighbors and, you know, talk to Mr. Roberts and Ms. Johnson down the street and just play basketball with little Timmy, right? We want to be treated equally. We're saying Black Lives Matter because we feel like for the last couple years, not really years, decade, even as you go back to Black Power, you know, when they put their fist up, they made it very clear, you know, this is us, this is our power, you know, we have a voice, this is our moment. So pay attention to us because we feel like the world does not care about us. We feel like, and as, like I say, it's not, we feel, there's statistics, there's facts all the way back from other commissions have proven that people of color have not been given the same opportunities, that have been treated differently when it comes to law enforcement, housing, education,
all across
the board.
There's already studies on things like missing children and kidnappings. Like, kidnappings of young white kids get a lot more press coverage, right? Like, we're saying, the news is saying, viewers are saying, that little kid's life matters more. I mean, that's kind of, and so it's just, it was kind of very common sense and clear to me why it's important to say Black Lives Matter. And the reaction is just, you know, I mean, I guess it's predictable. I guess it's, you know, I don't want to read too much into it. And not everyone who dislikes that phrase is a raging racist. I think they're just misinterpreting it. They're thin skinned and they're kind of reactionary, but
they're missing the point to people who don't to understand. Once again, like I say, it's not an anti-white thing. You know, Black Lives Matter is just saying, hey, we want to be treated just like you are.
Well, and every loss of life is tragic. And so, you know, I remember seeing, I don't know if it was like maybe on billboards around St. Louis or something, saying police lives matter. It's like, yeah, but we've already all agreed on that. Like,
and
that's why we support police. That's why we, you know, and maybe they deserve more support even, but, and people can make that argument, but we honor a fallen police officer.
We do.
In a very significant way as an entire community. And so you don't have to, you can say it, but that's not an opposition. I don't know. It's a real false equivalence. It's a weird way to address the issue.
And it's kind of also a smack in the face with the police signs. And I mean, not the police signs, you know, we support police. I mean, as you see across the country, the police are held to the utmost respect. And no one is saying that they don't have a tough job. I feel, you know, police, they do have a tough job, but that doesn't defeat the purpose of, they just can't go rogue in certain communities and just release any force and not feel that there's no consequences. But
when they shouldn't be used to fund a community, to build a city hall and to balance a budget and stuff like that, which is getting back to the point of, like, if you could get rid of some of those issues, maybe that, you know, that de-escalates the day-to-day situation, so that when something like, you know, when a Michael Brown gets shot, when something tragic happens in a community, there's not this tension build up where people are just ready to go.
I mean, you know, the officer, you know, I always say, what happened to, I mean, I remember when I used to stay at Murphy Park and the police used to come, you know, in our back gate, and they used to hand out baseball cards. Baseball cards are not cool anymore. No one cares about baseball cards.
I've got like 10,000 of them if you want them. Yeah. And they're worth nothing.
At my mom's house, there's a whole box of baseball and basketball cards. But But I mean, just the, you know, that, you know, going and trying to build a rapport, trying to get to know the community. It's none of that anymore with, I mean, police officers.
Well, and it's hard when we live apart. And I'm, because I'm really good at bad analogies, here's another one. I ride my bike to work every day, and I have days where I'm just in a bad mood, and I start assuming that every car passing me is going to, like, swerve or yell at me or something like that, man. And when it happens, like, I've just let loose on people, and it's just, like, totally unfair. Like, totally not. But it's a level of, you know, it's a level of distrust, and it's a level of, like, just being tense and realizing, like, man, something happens, I'm going to interpret whatever this next person does in the worst way possible, and I'm just going to go for it, you know. And it's a bad, and that is a terrible, terrible analogy. So I apologize, but
it's a little, that's a scary situation.
But that's like a tiny, but it's like, it resonates with me, because that's like a tiny, completely inconsequential situation that no one's going to sympathize with, and they shouldn't. But it gives some insight. If I can get so fired up on something so trivial and dumb as that, when you take that to a level across the community and you're talking about people's livelihood and their lives, literally their lives, but also just their well-being, you know, you have a community that can erupt.
Definitely. Definitely. Like you say, especially when you're messing with how people live on a day-to-day basis, and you're saying, this is how you should live, this is how you shouldn't live. It's like, you know, hold on, brother. Like,
so, so we'll wrap things up, and I want to thank you for all your time. This is, I think it's been enlightening and interesting to hear about your work and your involvement and your perspective on the community. Two things I want to hit on right at the end. This sounds lighthearted, but you can take it whichever way you want. You got your grandma arrested. Why would you get your grandma arrested?
'Cause granny's down for it. Yeah. Granny,
you told her, right?
She's the biggest. I mean, my granny is the biggest supporter. Even when I told her I was running for, you know, office, she was like, I'm knocking every door, I'm gonna be talking to everyone. When I told her about the fight for 15, and I was like, Gray, you know, I'm gonna take civil disobedience because I'm so passionate about, you know, this issue, and I think people should get a little away. She's like, if you do it, I'm going to do it with you. So I got arrested, but she offered. So it's not completely on me. Granny wanted to get a little riled up out there too, but it meant so much when she did, you know, sit down. She hurt her knee trying to get in the paddy wagon, but when she sat down and got arrested with me and other workers, because it's a serious issue to me and, for Granny to... I mean, she's an old woman, and she's pretty old. And, you know, sit down on the street to get arrested. It showed how much she cared about me, but also how much she cared about the issue. So,
is she from here? Did your grandmother grow up in St. Louis?
She grew up in Chicago, okay. And then when my mom was born, moved to St. Louis.
Gotcha. All right, and then let me give you a chance to talk about what you're doing next. You're tomorrow. You're protesting or have an activity for the Fight for 15. Can you tell us what that is and what you're doing?
So tomorrow, across the whole country and even international.
And this will actually post like in a couple of days. So this will be, it'll be in the past when people listen to this, but you know, go ahead.
So should I say tomorrow or Thursday?
Yeah, Thursday. So this will, yeah.
Okay. So this Thursday on the 14th, fast food workers, home care workers, and child care workers, once again, across the whole United States, are taking and going on strike for a livable wage and the right to unionize. It started back in 2013 when New York workers went out on strike demanding the right to, you know, have more money, the right to make a livable wage and the right to have a union. And then it slowly spread it to Chicago and St. Louis and so on and so on. So, on the 14th tomorrow, once again, low-wage workers all across the country are going out on strike. But what's really cool about this one is I've been having the opportunity to organize and meet and learn like this childcare industry. And when I say it's so broken and it's literally a crisis, and it's sad that we only, you know, pay childcare teachers $7 and $8, and the state is not giving them more subsidies and not funding early childhood. It's really ridiculous, but childcare teachers are actually joining in the fight this time with fast food workers. Last year, they joined in when we had Megan Green, who's super amazing when it comes to this issue. She had spoke outside of daycare center, and this Thursday we're going to have Bruce Franks, who's a candidate for state rep, who's going to be there and speak with childcare teachers and directors. It's going to be an exciting event with what's going to be going on at WashU and SLU.
Right.
It's
you have faculty members and students walking out.
Students and faculty walking out. At the end of the day, it's really this message of whatever you're doing. I mean, you should make a livable wage.
Yeah.
It don't matter if you're flipping burgers, because that's a hard job. And I did it. And it's not easy to take orders in one ear and also to take money and to also try to, you know, get the drinks.
If we would all pay $3.40 for that burger instead of $3.25, people could make a real wage.
It only
takes
28 cent. Yeah. If people pay 28 cent more on a burger, and which technically the McDouble, it's already like $2. It used to be $1. It's $2. So if we would have paid that 28 cent, then we would have been able to, you know, give people a livable wage, and that goes.
So you're out you're in St. Louis City tomorrow as part of this group speaking.
Yep.
So, and so people will be able to read about it when after they listen to this. So last thing, we ask everyone who comes on, we call this the Future Great City podcast. So what does it take? What does St. Louis need to do to be a future great city? And I always say, it used to be population growth. It was like, if we were a growing city, like people look at Atlanta and think that place is really, you know, rocking, and because they're growing, and so everything else must be fine, which is probably not accurate. So maybe it's not that anymore. But in your view, what needs to change, and how do we become a great city?
We need new ideas in the city. We need bold ideas. And being in this space, the space location, as I was just walking around, I mean, some of the drawings and some of the pictures and just some of the architect, I mean, it's something that's different to St. Louis. I mean, when I've been able to travel to these other cities, you look around these other cities and you look at the buildings and you just look at their parks and you just look at like the sculptures they have. It's different. It's not necessarily like this beautiful art, but it's just different. It's bold. And I think St. Louis is we're very stuck in the past. But I think, there is new leadership that is emerging in St. Louis, and I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that, you know, this new leadership is going to bring these new bolder ideas, we have to think bigger and we got to think bold. We can't think necessarily what, and I know it's always about the mighty dollar, if we got enough money, but we always manage to find money for something. We got to start thinking big and bold of how do we redesign our city? How do we make our city look different? How do we bring in people? And it's, we have to, I think, take a little bit of risk for people to be like, I want to go there. There's, you know, St. Louis is a beautiful place as it is. I'm not going to lie. We have beautiful architecture, but we have to think a little bit more outside the box. And I think we're behind time. We got to catch up, and we're behind time.
All right, man. We'll leave it with that. But thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
This has been the Future Great City Podcast on NextSTL.com. Thanks for joining us. Be informed, be engaged, be part of what's next. NextSTL.com.